and welcome to The Good Life with Danny Yamashiro. The Good Life Hawaii Radio Show is a program of Danny Yamashiro Ministries, a division of Jesus Christ is Calling You. Contact Danny on Facebook and Twitter or visit him at www.thegoodlifehawaii.org. And now, experience the good life today.
Aloha from Honolulu, Hawaii and Boston, Massachusetts. I'm Danny Yamashiro with my co-host, Suzanne Maurer.
Aloha.
Welcome to The Good Life. We're here to help unleash your God-given purpose. During the Vietnam War, U.S. Navy Captain Gerald Jerry Coffey was flying a combat mission off the USS Kitty Hawk. He was shot down by North Vietnamese anti-aircraft guns. He was held prisoner for over 7 years in the infamous Hanoi Hilton, a communist prison where torture and solitary confinement were routine. He survived. His keynote talk has inspired thousands worldwide with a message of hope, faith, courage, and honor. Do you need a dose of hope and courage today? Does your faith need some inspiring? Do you need to know or be reminded of the value of honor? We pause for a moment at the beginning of our show, as we typically do, to remind you the reason we have the Good Life radio program is to bring you the hope that is found in Jesus Christ. Dear friend, whatever you're facing right now, whatever challenge is before you, however low things might be or however down you might feel, there is always hope in Christ. And God has sent us here together to be with you, to remind you about the power of the resurrection. Yes, that Christ loves you so much, He died on the cross for your sins. He shed His blood on that cross to wash your sins away. Away, completely. Yes, away. He was buried, and 3 days later, He rose again from the grave. And today, the living Christ makes it possible for you to have a personal relationship with God because of what He did in your place, for what He did in my place and Suzanne's place. His sacrifice of love, dying for us, for you and me. And not only that, 3 days later, He rose again from the grave. And that's the power of the resurrection. Doesn't it bring you hope just hearing me say it? A historical fact. Indeed, Jesus is alive. And because He lives, there isn't anything that you face today that Christ, with His help, with His strength, Christ can bring you through. Truly, He can. And He will. Would you open your heart to Jesus? Would you bring your concerns to Him? Will you surrender your life to Jesus as your Savior and Lord? Captain Jerry Coffey, he did that. He experienced the love and the power of Christ. And he's here with us through a pre-recorded interview that Suzanne and I had with him. And he's going to share his story with you today. His book is entitled Beyond Survival. He describes his experiences in gritty detail. So now join us in this pre-recorded interview with Captain Jerry Coffey. Jerry, where did you grow up?
I grew up in the Central Valley of California, in a small town of Modesto, California, and spent much time with my grandparents in a rural setting. Went to Modesto High School and then to Modesto Junior College, and ultimately managed to cram 4 years of college into five. I graduated from UCLA in 1957. And because I got my draft notice and my diploma about the same time, I decided that I wanted to have a little more control over my future. So I checked out Naval Aviation, and I liked the beaches at Pensacola. So I decided to go Naval Air.
Who would you say, Jerry, influenced you most in your growing up years?
My grandfather, I think. He was a gnarly little guy. He was very short in stature. In fact, both of my grandfathers. I was very lucky to know all four of my grandparents, and I spent a lot of time with them while growing up. During the World War II years, we moved from Modesto to the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, and both of my one other grandfather had a job in the shipyards. And he was an electrician, and then came back to Modesto, and before we even got settled in, because housing was so short during those days, we lived with my grandparents in the country for nearly a year before we were able to find our own place to live. And that way I got closer to my grandparents and enjoyed the benefit of their wisdom and their love and along with my parents.
What do you remember? You talked about wisdom that they shared. Anything stand out in your memory of what Grandma and Grandpa taught you?
Yeah, yes, I do. Ken is in a nutshell of the existing AA pledge. Lord, help me to change the things that I can, to endure the things that I can't, and the wisdom to know the difference. And that's been helpful to me most of my life, to be able to fall back on that basic philosophy.
Mm-hmm. How about your faith? How did you become a Christian?
Danny, I was baptized as a Methodist when I was young. I was baptized as an Episcopalian, and I was baptized as a Christian church. And I used to attend whatever church my friends attended. But that was a good way to back things up and to make sure I was fully covered from as many points of view as I could. And then when I was married, my wife had been raised Catholic, and I converted to Catholicism. We raised our four children in a Catholic church. And all in all, I had a pretty broad-based religious experience when I was just a kid. My mom and dad weren't particularly religious, and they didn't ever belong to a single church. But I was always attracted. I was a Boy Scout, and God is mentioned very prominently in the Boy Scout oath. And so I never in my entire life doubted the existence of God and doubted his role in my life, although the strength of that belief varied considerably from friend to friend.
During the 13-day Cuban Missile Crisis, October 1962, as a lieutenant, your photos were among those used as proof for Soviet strategic weapons used by Ambassador Adlai Stevenson to the United Nations. Were you aware that the photos you were taking would have impact on avoiding nuclear war?
There was certainly a relationship to the reconnaissance that I was gathering in my fellow photo pilots during those 13 days, but not to the extent that it finally came to be. I didn't even know that I had taken photographs that first revealed the existence of the tracked missiles, tracked-borne missiles in Cuba. On about my third or fourth mission, I was keeping up with my leader, who was ahead of us, ahead of me, and we were going about 450 miles per hour at 500 feet, and we were relying on the element of surprise for defense mostly. And that turned out to be successful. And I glanced over to my left. We had to navigate by DR, dead reckoning. That is to say, we had no nav aids like TACAN or any radio aids to aid us in our navigation. So it was all visual and all up to the pilot to both fly the airplane and to navigate. So on about my third mission, I noticed I was coming across a missile site. But while I was going across the missile site with my cameras running, I noticed off to my left and supposed to leave the flight track that we planned, but just almost automatically, I went into a very steep left-hand turn and pulled G's hard to make it so that I would roll out with my wings level going across that motor pool. And then after I went across it, I turned back on my normal course and caught up with my leader, who was just about to go feet wet over the Straits of Florida on our way back. But what I had seen was a motor pool which contained the very first frog missile weapon system. And they were nuclear, had nuclear-tipped warheads. And it was the first indication that they were even in Cuba. And when the Marines that were planning for the possible inevitable invasion of Cuba from the north across the Straits of Florida, when they saw those, they realized that the ships that were carrying the troops over would be sitting ducks to nuclear missiles.
When you think about the timing and the convergence of what was happening in Captain Jerry Coffey's viewpoint, at that point not knowing the full impact of what would take place, and the, well, as you could say, the geopolitical scenario that was playing out with Cuba and Russia and America during this very tense period. It would be so volatile that a disaster like never before seen could have taken place. And yet God uses Captain Jerry Coffey to bring about information that could, and I'm oversimplifying things for sure, but avoid a nuclear disaster. Is God able to work in those ways even still today? Are there things that we might be working on and working toward that have great impact, even though we don't see it, even though we don't know it? When we come back from our break, Suzanne Maurer and I will continue in our pre-recorded interview with Captain Jerry Coffey. Captain Coffey was not only heroic in what he did in his surveillance, he did some heroic deeds for an extended period of time, years, during the Vietnam War. And he's here to tell us some of those details. And as he shares it, the way he shares it, oh, it's bound to inspire you. Stay with us. We'll be back with more.
Wandering the road of desperate life, aimlessly beneath a barren sky, leave it to me.
Active lifestyles are promoted for healthy living. This involves exercise and a range of sporting activities. There are times, though, when injuries take place resulting from sports, work, or even the effects of age. In some cases, surgical care is necessary to facilitate proper healing. That's the time to call orthopedic surgeon Dr. Calvin Oishi, with offices at both Polymomi and Kuakini. Dr. Calvin Oishi has treated patients with the compassion, care, and expertise second to none. Call orthopedic surgeon Dr. Calvin Oishi, 484-2042. 484-2042.
There was a time when filling up your gas tank was a full-service experience. The attendant would look under your hood, check your oil and water, check your tires, and wipe your windows, all while your tank's being filled. Burt's Union Service Station on School Street still does it. They also provide auto repair services with master mechanics to give your car the needed fixing to keep it going a long time, so your dollars stretch with a lasting, smoothly running vehicle. Visit them today. Burt's Union on School Street.
You're listening listening to The Good Life with Danny Yamashiro. The Good Life Hawaii Radio Show is a program of Danny Yamashiro Ministries, a division of Jesus Christ is Calling You. Contact Danny on Facebook and Twitter or visit him at www.thegoodlifehawaii.org. Now, let's rejoin Danny and his special guests.
Welcome back to our show. Danny Yamashiro here with my co-host Suzanne Maurer. Thanks again for joining us. We have a special guest by way of a pre-recorded interview with Captain Jerry Coffey. Suzanne, as we talked with Captain Coffey, what stood out to you in that privileged moment that we had together with him?
Well, I don't know if others would have caught this, but 450 miles an hour, 500 feet above the earth, just what he had to do. And then, as you explained, what could have resulted, boy, God had him in a unique place, kept him safe, but it's just hard for me to grasp just that aspect. And then, of course, I know the rest of the story, so it's going to be very fascinating for our listeners to hear Jerry continue on with his life. It's unique.
Well, let's go right back to where Captain Coffey left off. Now, here's more with Captain Jerry Coffey.
That were being stationed by the Soviets in Cuba. So about a month after that flight, I got a very generous letter from the commandant of the Marine Corps, General Shoup, and it was very flowery. He says, never before in the history of our Navy Marine combat team has such valuable intelligence been gathered, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what it did was enable them to reevaluate the amphibious landing that they had spent a great deal of time investing our planning and our logistics, and they changed the whole strategy of any invasion plans that we might have had of Cuba. So that was pretty amazing, and it was very humbling to realize that just on the spur of the moment, because of my reaction to what I saw, and probably the sum total of my training, I was able to get those pictures and provide that information for our the strategic information for our war planners, and it was a very self-fulfilling thing that I had been able to accomplish, even though I didn't know I was doing it at the time. And then I flew about three or four more missions after that, one of which took me from Key West, Key West, Florida, where we were based during that time. I flew to Guantanamo Bay with a wingman, and then we refueled at Gitmo and took off and flew along the southern coast of Cuba and turned and north to cross the island and went right across Holguin Air Force Base, where MiGs were already taxiing out, armed with missiles, air-to-air missiles. And we had the pictures of them coming out, but it also enabled us to determine that the Cubans were loading those missiles on freighters in the port that was right there in the southern part of the island, and that our strategy to neutralize that nuclear threat was working. Mm-hmm. It was a special time for us, those of us on the front lines, Danny, because, you know, most of the time we train and train and train, especially as photo pilots and the fighter pilots as well. And we don't really have an opportunity then to see the fruits of that training. But in this case, my mission was very fulfilling, and we're able to see the results of our training and of our professionalism. And that was very special to me. It was an opportunity that every one of our fighting men and women should have one time or another in their career. And I was very lucky to be in the right place at the right time.
Well, the
I can only imagine that they feel it, they live it, they feel the appreciation, they feel the fulfillment through you being able to share and having shared what you share, the significance of what has taken place. Now, Jerry, you went on from there, and as you continued flying Vietnam, yes. What were the circumstances that caused you to eject while flying over Vietnam?
The Cuban missions taught us that there's a great deal of defense in surprise. And if we could fly low and fast, by the time the people on the ground with guns even realized that we were there, we would be gone, and all they would be left standing in the wake of our sonic boom as we went across the target areas. But Washington, in all their wisdom, decided that that was too dangerous, and that the small arms fire was too dense in Vietnam, and indeed some guys were shot down with arms fire instead of anti-aircraft guns or SAM missiles, but not many. And early on, the command leaders in Washington decided that we would fly at a higher altitude and slower. Well, the altitude that they chose was about 4,000 feet, and smack right in the middle of the AAA, the anti-aircraft gun capability. And we began losing a lot more pilots and planes because of the guidance that came from the ill-informed or the uninformed in Washington, D.C., and that was one of the hallmarks of the Vietnam War. So much of it was fought tactically, or I should say strategically, from Washington, when those of us who were actually doing the tactical missions had a better feel for what would work, and we could never get that responsibility changed. So I had bitterness would be too strong of a word. I was disappointed that they didn't take our input and value it more. But they, you know, Washington always thinks it has knows better. So that was one of the real problems with Vietnam, is too much of it was fought from the desk of Washington D.C. war planners and strategists there than on the flag level, the command level out in the jungles of Vietnam.
So as you were flying on this mission that you had to eject, what caused you to have to make that call to eject?
I didn't make the call myself. It wasn't my idea. When I was still on the flight deck of the carrier, one of my squadron mates ran up to the plane and climbed up the ladder, which was still attached to my airplane. And he thrust into my hands a map of the general area where I would be flying anyway. And across the map, he and the intelligence people down in the IOC, Intelligence Operational Center, had drawn a red line across the map as a flight path. And he said, "Hey, Jerry, since this is the last launch on the last day on the line before we go into port in Hong Kong, the A-6 guys, which are attack airplanes, need some coverage for this area here so they can do their mission planning for when we come back out of Hong Kong." And so it was, you know, a typical can-do attitude. And I said, "Sure." And I took the map and put it on my knee pad. And then after I finished doing the mission that I was originally briefed on, and then I went to the beginning of that red line and flew down that red line. And as it turned out, the red line, because I didn't receive that map up down in the intelligence spaces, I didn't realize that red line was going right through the most dense anti-aircraft section of the central Vietnam. And so, and of course, we would fly our missions and jink the airplane back and forth, and that means making
as many turns as we could, so you never flew with your wings level in a straight line for very long at a time, because that would then you try to interrupt the gun tracking procedure of the enemy then, as they try to train their guns on their airplane. Nevertheless, I took a hit from a AAA gun, and the hit disabled my hydraulic system. But I was able to, my controls allowed me to turn back toward the ocean and to accelerate toward the ocean, because, of course, I wanted to get as far out to sea as possible in case I would have to leave the airplane, which I did. But I wasn't able to get far enough before I lost all control. My control stick froze in my hand, and I couldn't turn the airplane. And I was able to turn it at first, and then it was in a turn, but then I couldn't come out of the turn because the hydraulic system had been disabled, and the airplane was flying the A5 Vigilante, RA5C, is steered by hydraulics. And gradually, I lost all control, and the nose began to drop down to the horizon. And I'd gone into afterburner to accelerate to get out to sea quickly. But anyway, the nose dropped down, and I began going down fairly rapidly. I was down through about 4,000 feet and closing with the ground rather quickly, and realized that we couldn't stay with the airplane. So I called on my crewman to sit behind me, kind of in tandem fashion. His name is Bob, and from Toledo, Ohio. And I said, "Bob, eject, 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 eject." And I didn't hear him go. And the ejection system in the plane works in a way that if the pilot initiates the ejection, the crewman goes out first. There's an interconnect between the two seats. Mm-hmm. So I ejected him and then myself a second later, which is automatically follows on. And we were rolling rapidly, totally out of control, and way, way out of the safe ejection envelope for airspeed and altitude. But at that time, there was no choice. We had to go for it. And when I ejected, then the seat went out. I was knocked unconscious immediately from going out at such a high speed.
What do you do? What do you do when you lose all control? Of course, Captain Coffey is talking about losing control of his aircraft. He has to eject, but his controls froze. The hydraulic system didn't work. What do you do? What do we do when we lose control of aspects of our lives? What do we do when we lose control of our lives? What happens then? Is there another part to the story? Well, just like there's another part to the story of Captain Jerry Coffey, which he will share as we come back from our break. But as we go into our break now, I ask you, what do you do when you lose control? Is there some point of hope when you feel like possibly all hope is lost? Is there another point where more help can come when you've lost all the help that you thought you could have for yourself? Help, hope, help and hope. There's always more through Christ. And when Captain Coffey comes back, he'll share more. Stay with us.
Wandering the road of desperate life, aimlessly beneath the barren sky. Leave it to me, I lead you home.
Have you heard the stories on the Good Life Hawaii radio show with Danny Amashiro and his guests?
Yup, I listen to Danny's show every day. Those testimonies inspire me in my life at work, with my family, and in my relationship with God.
Did you ever visit thegoodlifehawaii.com? There's all kinds of resources there. Danny Amashiro has interviewed hundreds of guests on subjects like parenting, business, relationships, depression, overcoming addiction, hope, and so much more.
As a matter of fact, I have. Did you know there are videos where Danny prays for your family, your finances, even a video I've used to help lead my friends to Christ?
Wow. And I hear Danny is offering special opportunities and benefits for his Good Life Partnership Club members.
Yep. Go to thegoodlifehawaii.com and remember to connect with Danny on Facebook. Follow him on Twitter, too. That's Danny Yamashiro.
I'm going to visit thegoodlifehawaii.com today.
Listening to The Good Life with Danny Yamashiro. The Good Life Hawaii Radio Show is a program of Danny Yamashiro Ministries, a division of Jesus Christ is Calling You. Contact Danny on Facebook and Twitter or visit him at www.thegoodlifehawaii.org. Now, let's rejoin Danny and his special guests.
Yeah, what do you do when your life is spiraling, literally spiraling out of control? Well, that's a story of Jerry Coffey, flying over Vietnam. There he is, emergency ejection, he and his co-pilot, and he's knocked unconscious because of the force of the ejection as his fighter plane was spiraling out of control. There is a parallel in this graphic figure that we see in our mind's eye. What about our lives when we spiral out of control? You're listening to The Good Life Radio Show. Danny Yamashiro with Suzanne Maurer. Thanks for joining us. Hey, you can find out more about this program at thegoodlifehawaii.com. You can find out more about Captain Jerry Coffey at captaincoffey.com. Again, captaincoffey.com. There are times in our lives where we hit our own point of quote unquote unconsciousness, where we don't have the wherewithal because of the circumstances to even be able to make a decision to call on God. And that's, I think, where we really need the mercy of God, the grace of God. And the beauty of it is that God in his mercy is there. He's there with us. Certainly, if you're able and you can think and you can process, by all means. But even in the depths of our inabilities, the grace of God, maybe at that point, other people praying moves the hand of God in ways that are mysterious. We can understand some of it, but not all of it. But the marvelous mercy of God's grace. Hey, Suzanne, let's take a moment in this pre-recorded interview and let's let our dear listeners, dear one, listen in further as Captain Coffey relays his incredible story with us.
I finally regained consciousness floating in the water. I had already removed my oxygen mask. I had cut myself free of my parachute to keep from being entangled in the shroud lines in the water. And I could see my crewman maybe 60, 70 yards away, floating in the water with his life raft inflated already. But beyond him, closer to the beach, I could see six or seven North Vietnamese boats coming out toward us. They were small boats that were being sculled along very slowly. But they were working their tails off to get out to us very rapidly. And so there were about six or seven army and militia men in each boat. And I assessed the situation and realized there was no place to to escape. My arm was broken. I couldn't swim. It became apparent that our capture was a sure thing. And the first boat reached me, and the guys reached down and had all their guns and machine guns and rifles and things trained on me to make sure that I didn't try to anything tricky or to escape, which would have been absurd to do that because I was in the water. I couldn't swim with a broken arm. And so they grabbed me and pulled me into one of the small skiffs and started stripping me of my flight gear. And I was carrying a 38 pistol that my granddad, that I mentioned before, who was also with the sheriff's department in Modesto. But I realized that was an inadequate weapon, so I pulled that pistol out of the holster and let it sink so that they wouldn't get the benefit of it, at least. And hauled me into the boat, and we were headed toward the beach. And before we could reach the beach, we were strafed by our own airplanes, some A-1 Sky Raider attack airplanes. And I can recall very clearly pulling myself up along the gunwale of the inside of that boat and watch the A-1s roll in and shoot rockets at us. And the noise was horrendous, the rocket streaming in, and the 50-millimeter machine gun bullets piercing the surface of the water and throwing up big plumes of water all around the boat. And the noise and the smell and the cordite of the guns that the Vietnamese were shooting as they fired back at the airplanes rolling in on them. It was a very confusing moment, and the smell of cordite was very strong in the air. And it was amazing. They didn't sink the boat that I was in, and I think they might have hit the boat that had pulled my crewman, Bob Hansen, in. And because I never saw him after that incident, I think that the boat that he was in was hit and sank, possibly by our own airplane shooting at them, thinking that they were still searching for us and looking to pick us up. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been shooting at them. Anyway, we finally reached the beach and jumped out of waist-deep water and ran across a wide expanse of sandy beach and dove behind a rice paddy dike which bordered the beach. And just as another airplane, an A-4 Skyhawk, rolled in, fired a pack of rockets, which blew those beached boats to splinters, and just barely missed where I was dug in and where the Vietnamese had pushed me down in the sand to make sure I didn't try to run or escape. And pretty soon, all the airplanes left and quiet settled in, and I realized through a very hazy, foggy consciousness that I had just been captured and was now a prisoner of war, something you never think is going to happen to you.
Mm-hmm. Jerry, what were you thinking through this when you regained consciousness, when they came out, they got you, guns pointing at you, pulled you back in, took you to shore, airplanes coming, strafing, just blasting away? What went through your mind and how did you feel?
There was so much going on, Danny, that I was just trying to assimilate and kind of keep track of the order of things, and it was a pretty scary situation as well. So I think my brain was pretty clouded with some by fear, because I had fear for my future, obviously, although I really didn't have a lot of time to think about what was going to happen immediately after that. But being a POW, a prisoner of war, is one of the things that one of the bad things that can happen to you, and here it was happening to me. And I was worried about my crewman because I didn't know his fate. And as it turned out, I think he was killed that day by the Vietnamese to pull him into their boat, at or maybe killed by our own airplane strafing his boat too by mistake. I never ever heard of him again, and it wasn't until 3 or 4 years into my captivity that a high-ranking Vietnamese officer showed me his military ID card to just prove to me that they had captured him too. I was asking new POWs with them that could come in contact if they'd ever run across a new guy named Robert Hansen from Toledo, Ohio, and nobody had ever heard of him or had met him or encountered him before being incarcerated up in Hanoi in the main prison system. So I'm pretty sure that he died that day, and I was captured and over a 12-day trek in a jeep-like vehicle over very, very rough and bombed-out roads. I was taken to Hanoi, the capital of North Vietnam, and to the big old prison in downtown Hanoi called Hualo, H-O-A-L-O, Hualo, that our media soon dubbed the Hanoi Hilton. And so we started calling it the Hanoi Hilton, too. And Wallo was an old French-built prison in downtown Hanoi, and it was just reeked of the misery and the agony that had taken place there. First of all, the French holding the Vietnamese there incarcerated, and then the Vietnamese holding Vietnamese incarcerated, and then now the Vietnamese holding Americans there as well. And it had a very sordid history, and it smelled like it now too, for that matter. So that was my introduction to North Vietnam.
They put you in a cell. Describe to us the size, the dimensions of it.
The cell was about the size of a single bed, and it consisted of about 4 by 6.5 feet long, 4 feet wide, 6.5 feet long, with a concrete bunk jutting out from one side. And at the foot of the concrete bunk was a set of leg stocks, old iron leg stocks that had a big, heavy lever that came down across the ankles and locked in place with a big, rusty padlock. And the ceiling was very high. It had one light bulb hanging from the ceiling, which was on all the time. And one window very high on the back wall of the cell, through which all I could see were a little sliver of blue sky and a bough of one of the trees that was planted out in front of the prison. But that was kind of a luxury compared to the view that some cells didn't have. And it smelled, it just smelled like, it smelled like nuoc mam, which is the sauce that they put on their rice. It smelled of the stinking bandages that were discarded in the corners of the cells and the passageways. And it was a very discouraging situation and kind of a shocking, and designed to be, I'm sure, kind of a shocking realization of where I was with so little control over my present and my future.
Jerry, at that time, did you have any idea how many prisoners of war were there?
I didn't really, Suzanne. But I knew that there were other guys there, just from our intelligence reports that we'd had and some of the information trickled down to the squadron level before I was shot down. So I was always confident that I wasn't the only one there. Although the first guy shot down, a friend from California, named a young Navy pilot named Everett Alvarez, he was there for a year and a half before anyone else was shot down. And all by himself, and that was spooky. And then the second guy shot down, Bob Shoemaker, was there for another year before there were any other POWs. So Alvarez and Shoemaker, although they were kept separate, and the communists didn't want any of us to know that there were other POWs in the prison at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Captain Coffey talks about other prisoners. He talks about how he kept his mind engaged. He talks about a communication system that developed so that they could keep each other in the loop of what was going on, really to create a community of prisoners through a secret form of communication. He shares those things and more. When we come back, he'll explain all that with you, with us. Hey, it's not always that you hear someone able to so clearly and vividly articulate what it's like to go through the darkest moments of life as a prisoner of war. A hero who was a prisoner and who brought and continues to bring hope to thousands and thousands of people all over the world. Captain Jerry Coffey. More with him when we come back.
Desperate life, aimlessly beneath the barren sky. Leave it to me, I'll lead you home.
In times of economic challenge, opportunities arise. All we need is someone to say, I believe in you. Michael Beasley, a senior executive of Kayani Team Aloha, has seen Kayani products improve the quality of people's lives. Michael Beasley says Kayani's mission is to empower people globally to experience better health, wealth, and a lot of fun. Contact Michael Beasley at 277-9528. Live outside the 9-to-5 workday. Become the CEO of your own business while Kayani handles the details. That's Michael Beasley at 277-9528. 277-9528. Active lifestyles are promoted for healthy living. There are times when injuries take place. In some cases, surgical care is necessary. That's the time to call orthopedic surgeon Dr. Calvin Oishi, with offices at both Palimomi and Kuakini. Call orthopedic surgeon Dr. Calvin Oishi at 484-2042, 484-2042.
Listening to The Good Life with Danny Yamashiro. The Good Life Hawaii Radio Show is a program of Danny Yamashiro Ministries, a division of Jesus Christ is Calling You. Contact Danny on Facebook and Twitter or visit him at www.thegoodlifehawaii.org. Now, let's rejoin Danny and his special guests.
Well, it is like turning our minds into almost like a movie set, or being able to watch the theatrics unfold right there on the movie screen. You could be watching Netflix, for all you know, listening to Captain Jerry Coffey tell the story of his life and his experiences, the smells, the sights, the sounds. Danny Yamashiro here with Suzanne Maurer. You're listening to the Good Life Radio Show. I'm glad, grateful that you're with us today. Well, he's talking about a very serious time in America's history. He's talking about a very trying time, to say the least, in his life. Dear friend, when you go through moments of challenge, those unexpected moments, what do you do? How do you survive? Well, God sends Captain Coffey to share some of the things that he did to survive there at the Hanoi Hilton as a prisoner of war. And you know what? Some of the things that he shares, we may not be able to, of course, we're not able to relive what he's reliving or live as he's living, as he's lived. But we go through our own moments. And some things are not just tactical and how to handle. Some things are even deeper than that. And what I mean by that is this: you can make it. You can go through it. And it's a power not your own. It's a power that comes from God, the power that comes from Christ, to help you not only survive, but even as in his life, to thrive through the darkest, deepest moments. Here's more from Captain Jerry Coffey.
2.5 years in Everett's case, and in another year in Bob Shoemaker's case, that they're all alone, and that alone is kind of a spooky situation, because if you're a POW, you certainly want somebody that's on your side to know you're there, so there's no glitches and you get forgotten. And when it comes time for the war to end and all the POWs are supposedly sent home, nobody forgets you. So it was a very important mission by each man early on to be known and to contact other Americans so that you'd be a known POW.
And it sounds like it was almost like a solitary confinement, in that you couldn't see
other people at that time. Yeah, and they tried to compound the spookiness of being held in solitary by not allowing you to see any proof that there were other Americans there held prisoner. And so for a long time, even though you could hear men scream in pain and other signs, you know, like the bloody bandages in the corners of the cells and the passageways and so on, and the other residue from other Americans who were being held prisoner, mm-hmm. even though we knew that we weren't alone there, they tried their best to keep us thinking that way. We weren't allowed to see another American POW. You have to turn and face the wall if you were outside your cell, and they were taking you to an interrogation, and they happen to bump into another American being escorted to a bath area or something like that, or to an exercise yard or to their own interrogation. They go to great extremes to make us think that we're there alone all by ourselves. Mm. And because they knew that the more uncertainty there was in our mind, the more pliable we would tend to be. And in some cases that worked to be true, but in many cases, most cases, it didn't matter. We had a code of conduct that were six brief articles that prescribe our behavior for being a POW, and most men had that committed to memory, and included all the things that we were supposed to do and not do. Mm-hmm. And the last article, number six, says, "I will always remember that I'm an American fighting man, responsible for my actions and dedicated to the principles which made my country free. I'll keep faith in my God and in the United States of America." Mm. And there were lots of times, there are a lot of times when you had to fall back on that article number six of the Code of Conduct.
Oh, I bet.
How did you keep your mind occupied in a positive way?
It varied from man to man, but I am basically an optimist, and I always have been. And I knew that I was going to come home someday, and that this was a unique experience that I was undergoing, and that when I came home, people would be interested in the experience just from the standpoint of how unique it was and what a challenge it was to me personally and to every other man who was held prisoner. And so I realized that when I came, I don't know if you're familiar with Viktor Frankl's story, the guy that was held as a POW in the German prisons of World War II, a Jewish man wrote Man's Search for Meaning. Unfortunately, I had not read it before I went to Vietnam and got shot down, but it was the first book I read when I came home. Mm. Viktor Frankl decided that he would stay alive. He wouldn't let them grind him down, because he was determined to come home and tell the world what it was like. And indeed, he did things like the Holocaust, mm-hmm. were related to the rest of the world by men like Viktor Frankl. And I decided that I needed to stay alive and to be kind and very conscious and aware of what was going on, and remember as much as I possibly could, and to remember that experience is the best teacher and the best way to record what is going on in your life. And so I took every opportunity that I could to absorb the experience, not just in the kind of a daily life kind of way, but to also analyze why they were doing this to me and what they wanted, and to explain the differences between a communist system and a democracy and a democratic system, and to be in the moment, I guess would be the best way to say it, because it's only in being in the moment that you can absorb with any sense of accuracy what is going on to you, with you, what's mm-hmm. happening to you. Mm-hmm. So it didn't take me long. Two things. First of all, I started praying, obviously. Mm. And prayer became a very important part of my daily routine. But I also began to keep my mind open to what was actually going on, and started keeping a mental record as to the reasons that they were treating me the way that they were, what they hoped to gain from that by with propaganda and meeting foreign guests who came to the prison or writing statements condemning the war. And that was, they looked at us as propaganda agents to be exploited. And that's why that's part of the reason they even kept us alive, was to exploit mm-hmm. us for that propaganda. Mm-hmm. But to be aware of that, kind of like a third person standing outside my circumstances and observing, and in such a way that I could ultimately, no matter how long I was there, that I could ultimately record it in a book or however, some way. And as it turned out, my book Beyond Survival was the fruit of that attitude. I was able to give a very thorough debriefing to our intelligence officers mm-hmm. when I came home. And of course, one of the things that we did was to maintain a list of POWs in our minds. Every time you contact a new man, we communicated within the prison system by tapping on the walls from cell myself, and I'll go into that in a second if you're interested. But would it be, you'd interrogate, and I say interrogate in a friendly way, every new man that you encountered to see if, first of all, if you ran across Bob Hansen, Mike Crewman, or other POWs that he'd been, with whom he'd been in touch. And every man started accumulating this list of other Americans, POWs, that were known to be POWs by the community existing there in Wallow Prison, because we knew that we need to share that list with our intelligence people, and also it gave every one of us kind of a sense of certainty and gratitude that we wouldn't be forgotten.
You know,
you talk about community and the importance of community. Dear friend, are you connected? Are you isolated? If you are isolated, open up a little bit and get connected. And if you are connected, open up a little bit and get even more connected and share your heart. Let others share their heart. Share your pain, your struggles. Those are lessons from the TAP quote that you and I and Suzanne, we can all apply in our lives. Lessons from Captain Jerry Coffey. You can find out more about him at CaptainCoffey.com. Hey, here's another thing. Stay alive. Stay alive. Stay alive, keep alive. And you know why? Well, then you can tell your story. And that story becomes a testimony. It becomes dynamic and powerful, even though it doesn't feel like it in those very difficult moments that we find ourselves in, perhaps even now or at certain times in our life. Dear friend, I hope that you've been encouraged today by the story of Captain Jerry Coffey. Again, you can find out more at CaptainCoffey.com. There's no better time than right now to share the love of Jesus with someone near you. If you haven't done so, this is the perfect moment to do it. Go to thegoodlifehawaii.com, click Get to Know Jesus. I'll get a special presentation for you there. Matthew 17:20, Jesus said, "If you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move. Nothing will be impossible for you." It's always a blessing to be with you. A special thank you to Captain Jerry Coffey. Again, CaptainCoffey.com. Until next time, along with my co-host, Suzanne Maurer, technical producer Leah Rodriguez, guest coordinator Jamie Lee Kwai, and web designer Arlen Nagata, I'm Danny Yamashiro. Remember, the Lord is with you. Let Him unleash your God-given purpose today.
Thank you for listening in on today's broadcast of The Good Life with host Danny Yamashiro. We hope that today's program has been a blessing for you. The Good Life radio program is listener-supported, and we'd like to encourage you to pray about becoming a sponsor or donor. Your support makes it possible for us to continue to minister to God's people through The Good Life. To become a sponsor or to make a donation, please visit thegoodlifehawaii.org. That's thegoodlifehawaii.org, and may God richly bless you with The Good Life.